It is June 20th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, we have a pre-recorded show, but that's okay because it's with Steve Wozniak, the inventor of the personal computer. It's time now for GeekSpeak. We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we have Steve Wozniak, the inventor of the personal computer, co-founder with Steve Jobs of Apple Computer. He hand-built the Apple I and Apple II. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. That's santacruzelectronics.com. You can visit us throughout the week at geekspeak.org. You can participate in our forums, ask us questions. Of course, you're welcome to email us as well. During the show, normally, we allow you to chat with us as well. We're here to help you out. It's one of the things we do. And who are the people that do it? My name is Lyle Troxell. Every week we also have Rick Philman. He answers the phones. He's not on air. We also have a smorgasbord of other geeks that come and join me. One of the more recent recruits, in fact, the most recent recruit, is Al Luckow. Al Luckow is a new media architect, and today he joins me. He's a good friend of Steve Wozniak. And so in any case, I said I needed to do a recorded show this week. Al says, hey, let's ask Steve to do it. So on Wednesday, Al and I went over to Steve Wozniak's house in Los Gatos and chatted about his early life being a geek. Now, a lot of people have asked Steve Woz, how it was like to start Apple with Steve Jobs and what the differences were and all those things. But I'd heard that enough. I didn't want to talk about that. So I started talking about things early on in his career, kind of like, you know, first time he did things. In any case, found out some really fascinating stuff I didn't know about Woz. Some things I did know about Woz just by doing some Wikipedia entries. Pretty cool stuff. Just to give you some street geek cred, let me just tell you what his patents are, because that's good enough for me right off the bat. He basically, one of his patents is called microcomputer for use with video display. That basically means if you use a microprocessor and you then connected it to a video display, you're using the patent that he invented. He basically was the first one to say, you know, I want my computer to talk to my TV. He has a list of patents that are kind of about that. That idea is so fundamental to computer use that it's hard to imagine a computer without that ability. Now, of course, we went away from TVs and went to, you know, other types of displays like CRTs, but his foundation was the thing that started it. So in any case, Steve Wozniak, Woz, is a quite impressive guy. And the one thing I'd heard about from a lot of people as I talked about going to talk to him is that he was recently on the D-list. Now, he did do Dancing with the Stars, and I watched that. That was fantastic. If you haven't seen Dancing with the Stars, I had never had. I watched when Woz was on. He's kind of an overweight guy in his 50s, probably. And he danced his heart out, and he was wonderful. And he showed a excitement and a positive attitude that few people have. I'm impressed by him. I'm inspired by him. Well, in any case, what I didn't know is he was on some show called The D-List. So I started with that.
TV show, My Life on the D-List by Kathy Griffin. One of the funniest comedians going, you know, one of the sharpest minds for thinking things up quickly. I really admire her. And I met her quite by accident. People started emailing me one morning, and all these websites said I was dating her. And I didn't know who she was. I swear to God, I don't watch television. I don't think about D-list shows. I don't watch any television. And I know I had tickets to a concert that I thought was Patty Griffin. It turned out it was Kathy Griffin. So I wound up seeing her at a local event. And I didn't really meet her then. But a friend on my behalf left some little dog treats for her dogs because she's a dog person. She called me up. She apologized for what she told the press. And then she started saying, we're going to do something. And she called me up one day and said, you're taking me to the Emmys. Oh, my God, that's like I won the lottery. I mean, I get to go to Disneyland. I'm going to the Emmys. I found, oh, to sit on a red carpet for 2 hours. Someone like me who likes talking tech, they're asking all these questions. I mean, the best they could do that was anything serious. What do you think about George Bush or something? Mm-hmm. But they would ask, you know, where'd you get your hair done and all this? And I had to smile for 2 hours. I had no idea this red carpet experience. I thought you just sort of walked by them and you were done in 1 minute.
But you stop at like every little place and answer questions.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know. I had no idea what a red carpet was. So I learned that badly. And we went into the Emmys. As soon as it started, she wants to be one of the cool people that ditch out of their seat after the camera spotted them in their seat or something. So we went out to a hamburger place for the whole Emmys and just came back for the party that night. I got to meet Ron Jeremy. I guess he was on the show.
Really?
She likes to get celebrities on the show that she says will help her make the A-list. Huh. So this friend on my behalf had written a little note saying, hey, you should date Steve Wozniak, a celebrity. You know, he'll get you some attention. And I think if the two of us had like gotten together and wound up married, it would have been quite wild. Quite a wild thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I can't match her for her style of comedy, but I could match her in other ways. I mean, I pointed at her computer and I said, oh my God, you have last year's iMac, because she was putting me down because I didn't know Dolce Gabbana and all these other names. You know, I had it wrong.
Right. But she didn't have her computer up to date.
Yeah. I got
so
that one. I can do a little bit of my deception trickery on her.
Okay. So when you were a kid, what's the first time you picked up a solder iron?
Let's see. First soldering iron. I probably didn't solder when I had my about age six. I had a crystal radio like everyone does. And then I had an electronics kit around age 7 or 8 that you plug the wires together. Got it at Christmas. So plug the wires in. And I don't think I soldered then. But boy, I know by fifth grade, I was soldering. I put together you know what? In my fifth grade science fair project, was a big, huge thing with hundreds of switches, hundreds of lights, and they were all soldered together and relays and everything. So I did a lot of soldering by then. Oh, you would flip one of 92 switches for a natural element like copper or iridium. And if you took the iridium, 77 lights would come on. They'd be the right lights in the right orbit positions. They would indicate which electrons in which orbit positions and whatever. I don't even know if they still do chemistry that way. It was big, and it was all the logic was basically relay based to solve a few problems of things relays couldn't do. You turn on the next switch up, and instead of adding one electron to it, it turns a bunch of those off and goes up to a different shell.
Right.
So chemistry works in weird ways. Yeah. So to get around that, I had to learn how diodes work for logic by only letting electricity go one direction.
And by
sixth grade, I built a huge tic-tac-toe computer with hundreds of transistors, diodes, resistors that would calculate the tic-tac-toe moves. Every move is a rule. So every rule boiled down to one transistor and a little logic circuit that figured out, is this the condition for this rule to apply? Right. Is there an X in this corner and an X in that corner and zero here?
Did it just play a legal game, or did it actually compete with you?
No, it played a legal game. It competed. It would and never lose. And basically, that was so many hundreds of parts. That was a lot of soldering. And the way I did it, I pounded nails into a piece of plywood, and I soldered the transistor leads right to the nails. That was what I had to do. Just little pounding nails.
And so this was all in fifth grade.
That was in sixth grade. And by eighth grade, I also built another machine with hundreds of transition diodes that could add binary numbers and subtract them. And that was a lot of soldering.
Yeah.
Hundreds of parts soldered together. Oh, also in sixth grade, I got my ham radio license. And back then, it was kind of expensive to buy a completely built and working ham radio. So you
an HP one.
You open up a box and there's all these parts in bags. And so I had a Hallicrafters. And there's the instruction book that tells you what to assemble first with your screwdrivers and then which parts to put in, how to solder. They even had instructions in the manual how to solder.
Yeah.
So I soldered together my entire transmitter and receiver, two different kits.
Do you still have it?
I might. It might be in storage. I might still
have a ham radio operating right now?
No, because the two licenses that I had in my life were both early age licenses, and they expired. Oh. I had a novice license in sixth grade that expired after 1 year, and I had a technician's license in 11th grade that expired after 5 years. So they expired, and you know what? I wasn't really that much into the ham radio. I was more into the building.
It's like
the journey is the reward.
Yeah.
I was into building it and then being able to tap out in Morse code and make a connection, write down the QST numbers and all that. But you know what? To actually talk to these people that were mostly, 55-year-old, conservative engineers and whatever, and I'm a little sixth grade kid, wasn't my world.
Mm-hmm. I blew my ham radio transmitter by not plugging the antenna in. I was trying to get it to work. I couldn't get it to work. What happened is I didn't have a load on it, and I burned out my output transistor. I think was what it was. That was a long time ago. I don't remember very well.
But,
and
but
I didn't build mine. I got it from someone else.
And those are the stories that we totally live and understand, and we have no idea. Nobody else, when I was in school, sixth grade, nobody else around me could ever understand any of these words or terms or
so,
philosophies
how
or what
big
to
was
watch
your
for.
Sixth grade class? Like how many people
just
were
normal.
There?
Just I don't normal. Know, 25, 30.
Okay, small
whatever.
Class. Yeah. So you felt alone from that perspective? Like there wasn't other people doing it?
No. Well, as far as this went, I had one little techie friend, and he was going to take lessons with me to get a ham radio license at the same time, but he didn't get one. Mm-hmm. Just me and my father, and really nobody to talk to about the ham radio. But I was doing all sorts of other little electronic things, like wiring house-to-house intercoms, and we'd go down to the electronics store and buy microphones and buzzers and rig up these circuits that I could push a button, it'll buzz his house, and then I can talk to him. And
I got to introduce you to a high school teacher of mine, Preston Q. Boomer, and he... One of the great stories, he grew up in San Jose, and one of the great stories he had is having like his house and his grandparents' house, and they were close enough where they could take the phone lines and connect them together. So what they did is they'd call one girl from one house and the other girl from the other house, and as soon as it started ringing, they'd connect the lines together with a tap.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so
I know that
the girls would pick up the phone and talk to each other.
I know that joke. I used to do it with blue boxes in college. I used to call an information operator in one city and an information operator in another city or the same city and connect them together with capacitors, basically. Yeah. And they'd sort of, I'm information. No, who do you want? No, I'm asking you, who do you want? I don't know. It was at one time they actually made a date. They were in the same building in Los Angeles, and they made a date to get together for lunch.
Because they knew each other now.
Yeah. No, they didn't know each other.
But
and they didn't know each other.
Yeah.
No, it was really successful.
Okay.
But going back to school, you know, you're doing some electronic stuff. You don't think of yourself as special in the world. You don't think it's ever going to be something you might even do as a job or a career. You just sort of have your little group. You form a clique. You tend to become an outsider because you like to talk to the electronics so much. It's such an exciting world. It can make all these things and do all these things. It's such a big part of your life that you become a very small group of people that can talk electronics, and you can't learn how to talk all the little, you know, the small talk, get through life that all the little sixth graders and seventh graders start to pick up the socialisms of, and, you know, they disdain people who aren't in their group.
So what happened after sixth grade? Did you find some more people that did have that click with you that could do electronics?
Very few. I found a few on my street that had engineers for parents, that knew how to read resistor codes, that had little collections of parts, that liked to hook together simple circuits they could read in popular electronics. So, yes, however, going very far, like learning computer logic, building tic-tac-toe machines, wiring an entire ham radio. No, I was pretty much alone in my whole neighborhood and group, but I never thought of it that way.
Did the kids that were kind of had the engineering parents and kind of could read resistor codes, did they come and take a look at your tic-tac-toe machine and go, this is great, and really get into it?
Well, they didn't understand a bit of the computer stuff. So oddly enough, of all the electronics I did, we loved talking about, you know, walkie-talkies coming out, communications, receivers, frequencies, antenna, said how do you methods to get them the right size and grid dip meters. We would talk all this electronics talk, but the computers, no. I did that all on my own. I had not one friend that was interested in computers that understood logic, De Morgan's theorem, and an OR gates.
Okay,
just did it on my own.
Hi, this is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. We have Steve Wozniak on. Also interviewing Steve with me is Al Luckow. We're in his home in Los Gatos, and we're about to start talking about some electronic stuff, and you just heard Woz mentioned and OR gates, and I just wanted to give you a little history about what those are, just get an understanding. To do a computer, you're basically talking about doing logic patterns with electronics. And one of these ways of talking about that, abstracting them a bit, is talking about and OR gates. Gates of electronic flow or electricity flow is why it's called a gate. And the basic idea is that you want to know the output is true or false. And to get the correct input output, you want to have your input set up correctly. So you diagram this in a logic way, in a logical mathematical way, if you will, and then you build it electronically, and this is what Woz was really good at doing. Let me give you an example of a AND gate. I'll take the weather, because Woz uses that as an example. You will get your raincoat if you both want to go outside and it's raining. So that's an AND situation. If it's raining and you want to go outside, you'll get a raincoat. You won't get a raincoat if only one of those things is true. They both have to be true. Because if you're not going to go outside, you're not going to get a raincoat. And if it's not raining, you won't get a raincoat. It doesn't matter what the other side is. So that concept of having two inputs and one output and both of them being true, causing the output to be true, is called an AND gate. The other very common one is an OR gate. And this, of course, is mathematically one or the other causes the output to be true. Let's say the output in this situation is picking up the phone, okay? When do you pick up a phone? Well, you pick up a phone when you want to call somebody or when the phone is ringing. It doesn't matter which of those things happen. If either of those happen, you will pick up a phone. So that's an or situation. If the phone rings, you'll pick it up. Or if you want to call someone, you'll pick it up. So that's a little bit of background on logic. Enjoy more about Woz and his amazing qualities.
The math level is only the math level of about a fourth or fifth grader, period. To learn everything about digital logic, everything goes into every bit of a design of any digital computer today. That's basically all the math level you need. I stumbled onto, there were no books about computers back then. There was nothing that said, here's what logic is. I stumbled onto a journal that went to special engineers, and my father was a very acknowledged engineer at Lockheed, solved some brilliant equations and all this.
In Santa Cruz?
Martin in Sunnyvale.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And so I found this journal. I started going through it. Pictures that described how one big TV screen worked itself out to be like 1,000 dots by 1,000 dots or some huge number of memory. The phosphors were a memory, mm-hmm. and it had a way to sense them. And I was so intrigued. I turned it over. And then
paper was using a CRT's. How was it sensing them?
Well, it actually sent out a beam, sensed whether it was on or off, and then refreshed it. So it was a dynamic memory.
Yeah.
But it was such an intriguing thing that it existed. Who would have ever known? And pictures of those big, huge, IBM 1403s or whatever they were, filling up rooms with all the different chunks of the computer. And I flipped the pages, and there was something about Boolean and an OR gates. And I started working out ones and zeros. I started writing ones and zero, zero and a zero, zero or zero is zero, zero or one is one. I started writing my tables, and I went through. And then they got up to this thing called De Morgan's theorem, and that pulled me into computers for the rest of my life.
Okay, tell me about Morgan's theorem.
You can write in a sort of a logic equation of, let's say, if it's Tuesday and the sky is blue, then dress casually. Yeah. Okay, that's an AND gate, but they turn it into an OR gate. If it's not Tuesday and you change the AND to an OR, it's not, the sky is not blue, then don't wear dress casually.
Yeah.
You could basically bunch of things inverted, turn them into nots, and change an and to an or. And basically it's a form of logical reasoning, but we had little diagrams that we'd write, with plus sign meant or, and a little dot meant and. I started practicing on paper, and I was so proud to have learned this, and I didn't even have algebra in school yet. It was like fifth grade, and this was just the most intriguing stuff in the world.
Were you doing this by yourself? Were your dad doing it with you?
No, oddly enough, no. I found the manual by myself. Maybe my dad handed it to me and said, you could read this, but I remember finding it in the hall closet. I went in my room, door was shut, and I just became intrigued with these things called computers. And I knew that my dad did electronics, but he did analog electronics, guidance systems and televisions, that kind of stuff. And so I never really included him much in the computers, but when I came up with building a tic-tac-toe computer, and we talked about gates, he would show me a circuit with a transistor and how a transistor and some diodes could make an AND gate. The element of digital logic. So he helped me a lot.
He electronics to do
He actually
logic,
understood computers, but I didn't think he did. I don't know how far he went because I started, by the time I was in high school, I was just designing every computer that was made, my version of it, my set of chips to make this digital equipment computer, my set of chips to make this variant.
And when you're
computer.
Saying your kind of your set of chips, basically the map of the transistors to do the AND and OR gates that you needed to do.
I jumped a few levels, but after I learned how to make gates out of transistors and diodes, the chip companies were starting up, and you couldn't afford a chip because you'd buy a chip that had maybe two little AND gates on it, like two transistors worth, and it would cost $50. That's probably $500 today.
Right, right.
No,
but the transistors were only a couple bucks.
Lockheed could afford it because they needed to save weight on their missiles. So
and
that's
power.
How that's why the chip industry started here, and the. So I would get chip manuals from my dad showing the latest chips you could buy. You could get two gates on a chip. And then eventually one year they went to four gates on a chip. Wow. And you could get a little adder. And then they went to two bits of adder on a chip, eventually four. So every time they had better, I'd pull out my chip manuals. And then I had a description of a computer, which God knows I stumbled into by accident as well. And it was a PDP computer at first, and then I got manuals for Hewlett-Packard computers and Varian and all the other companies. And I would look at a description of a computer, what kind of registers, what the instruction set is. Oh, my door is closed. I don't have one person in the world I ever spoke to about this stuff, not even my dad. And, that's interesting that they have these instructions that way. And then I would code up all the gates to decode bits and put them together. And my designs were crude at first, and then I made a game. And the game was, this applies to anybody doing anything in life that you want to do at. Maybe it's, even if it's singing or dancing, you know, you get done with something and go back. How could I make it better?
Yeah.
How could I make it better? You're competing with yourself. Well, over here, these two chips, I can kind of condense them. Oh, I have another idea. There's a chip comes out called an exclusive OR. It could replace that. And I have one extra exclusive OR that can actually work as an inverter if I tie it into plus and, you know, doing all these little tricks to save parts.
Mm-hmm.
So I got extremely.
You were proving and proving.
So
my game
became, how can I design a computer with the fewest parts? And after a while, I noted that my designs had half as many chips as the companies were making their computers. And I was just like in my first year of college, and I knew I was really good at it.
So you did this for a long time.
Yeah, and I never ever had hopes. I'd call chip companies. Could you give me the chips for a computer design? None of them would ever talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we could have some rejects. You could come test them, figure out which parts are good, which are bad. And that didn't intrigue me. I just wanted to build my computers.
Yeah.
So I never got anywhere as building. It was all on paper and pencil.
Most of these were – okay. So the tic-tac-toe computer was the last computer you made for quite a while?
No. That was in sixth grade. In eighth grade, I built the adder subtractor machine.
Oh, right. Binary adder.
Hardware, yeah. And, of course, then I had high school electronics, and then I got into – my electronics teacher said, you know all the electronics, and he got me to where I could go down to a company and program a computer. And now I got to learn programming, and programming is like logic. This – a step, and they add up – you know, all the right steps add up to some kind of solution. So that was the next fun in my life, was learning programming. And programming and computers go together.
What else were you doing during that time? You're going to school, of course. How were you
school?
In school?
Okay, I was in sports. I got my block letters in my schools. I pole vaulted in high school. I was skinny back then, and I would join clubs like the math club, mm-hmm. the electronics club, and I would be an officer. But so on the surface, I had a lot of positive things going in my life, and I had good grades. But I didn't have that social connection. And I read books. I was influenced by books about individualism, doing things on your own. You know, not following others. I started mm-hmm. thinking about. I think it was largely I was really against church, and I thought, why? Well, everybody goes to church, and they say all the same words, and they read these songs, sing these songs, and they're reading the words all at the same time. Wait a minute, they're all a group of followers. There's not one person out there that thinks, well, there's something I can think of that's intelligent on my own. So I decided that my God was in my head, and I started becoming very philosophically based, and it was towards an independence that I didn't want to do things only because others were doing them. And that kept me out of the social stuff, the drinking and parties and things that lead to sex and all that. I was just not really against it, but I said, if I'm going to drink, I should drink on my own alone because I think there's a good reason to, you know, at least the first time. So partying and friends, because I was – but it was sort of a two-way thing. I was sort of already an outsider with those people, so I wouldn't be in their parties, but I, you know, but then I would put down the parties, the something I wasn't in. So I wasn't totally thought out, philosophical, logical, rational, intelligent. I was partly just reacting to the situation you get put in when you're like that. And so I grew up very pure.
So through school, you stayed functional as a good student, doing sports, doing English, all the other skills you
yeah.
were.
Yeah,
good.
And absolutely. Right. Yeah, and science
and the entire
and
time
science,
figuring out computers.
No, science and math. I was at the top, which means well, there's always about eight people who are all at the top. But I would get the awards for math and.
I think it's pretty common about for geeks.
Electronics, Although I was electronics genius. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait.
So it's funny. I heard someone say that. No, they're not. Like
yeah.
Well, they would talk about it, but I knew how far. You know, the stuff that they measure genius by, I knew so much more than that. It wasn't even. I couldn't even talk to anyone.
Now, do you think that's because you started at a young age, or do you think that you have something biological about your brain structure that allows you to think better that way?
I think it's just accidents.
Really?
Who I met, what I encountered, what I ran into. Books. You know, I started reading books, and they were about scientific engineer heroes, and I watched movies and loved the scientists going under the sea and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. They just – accidents became my – it became my passion, maybe because I started out good in math at school.
Right.
And, you know, I attribute that almost to my mom gave me a little exercise with flashcards the night before we did it in class. So then when the teacher said, wow, you're the first boy that ever beat the girls at flashcard multiplication, I started thinking of myself as you know, when a teacher gives you praise about something, you start thinking you're good at it, you're going to work harder at it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I stayed just tops in math and science. And if you're good in math and science, everyone thinks you're a genius and they give you A's for everything else too.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. I'm with Al Luckow, and we're in Steve Wozniak's house in Los Gatos. Talking about his life as an engineer and geek.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisans coffee. coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317 Potrero Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Arto. Streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. Of course, GeekSpeak is geekspeak.org, and you can ask us questions on our forums and participate through email anytime you'd like. Now let's back to our conversation with Steve Wozniak.
When we showed up, one of the first things I asked you after looking at some cool games that you had out, puzzles, mind puzzles, was if you were coding. Because I'm curious about, are you still doing this kind of thing, or are you doing other things?
If I didn't have a whole ton of entrapments that, you know, I could point to, email being one of the largest ones, and all the news feeds you get on the internet, and life of people asking me questions, expect me to know things all the time. If I had more for that free time, yeah, I'd be coding, coding and building hardware. Oh, yeah.
Radio hosts pestering you for interviews.
Because my entire life was going to be dedicated to building things and writing programs. And now, and I've lost that, and I regret it deeply.
But you are, I feel, inspiring other people to do the kind of leading yourself through life that you do. I mean, when I saw you on Dancing with the Stars and kind of told other people to watch you, just the enthusiasm you had to engage in something, to not care about what other people thought and just do it anyway and show that everyone can do that, very inspirational. So from that perspective, you are creating more creativity in the world because you're inspiring other people to do it.
Well, Dancing with the Stars was a total accident. it doesn't belong. After you turn it down enough times, and your friends, some of your friends aren't like you. They aren't just a technical geek who could never imagine dancing in the life. Oh, do it. It's a big TV show. And I don't even watch TV. So I had never seen the show. I don't even know what dancing is. Yeah, that was a real, people say that was brave. That's an understatement.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know how I talked myself. I said, I'm going to jump in the water and learn how to swim. And I don't know, I've got to reach the shore or I die.
Right.
And I gave it to myself and I thought I was going to fail for quite a while.
So I have this radio show that I've been doing for like 9 years called Geek Speak. And all the time people ask me what geeks are. And lately I've finally gotten the crux of it. And I want to know if you agree with it. And it's basically the idea that everyone at some point gets extremely excited and wants to share something with somebody else. And that enthusiasm, you see it in 4-year-olds all the time, right? That enthusiasm, they motivates them and they find friends around it and stuff, but they also get kind of a critique and then they get teased by it, that overwhelming excitement they get teased by. And some people shut down and don't get excited like that anymore. And some people just get excited anyway, whether they don't know they're getting teased or they don't care. That's a geek. Someone
that's
keeps
a real
on
good description.
Holding on to excitement about stuff.
Yeah, I go in way other description, other directions when I try to define geekism, but that's really a lot more to the point because it's a generalization. Something, and not only that, you can be a geek in other areas. You could be a geek about just clothes or something. Yeah. You know, cooking. a girl that nobody pays any attention to, but she knows every little thing, collects all these magazines. Yeah, cooking. What you touched on is a lot of not caring what other people say about you, what they feel about you, being independent. And, boy, that was the heart of my geekism, which was in the normal area, electronics.
But so that's the thing that's so wonderful is that being so successful at doing that, you're now able to embrace anything with that, something that you're not necessarily the expert on, like dancing. You're able to grab it and go, I'm going to do this anyway. I don't care what other people think. I'm going to be excited about it. All right, so we were up into junior high and then in high school, kind of went through a little bit of that. And then in college, your young neighbor punk kid starts harassing you to do other things. Is that kind of a good assessment? Everybody asks you about meeting Steve Jobs and what you did there.
Oh, yeah. Partway through college, yeah, I finally got the chips to build a computer.
Now, how'd you get those chips?
I worked for, after 2 years of college, I didn't have the money for my third year of college at Berkeley, so I took a year off to work and earn the money. It let me buy a car and have the money for college, great opportunity, and I programmed. I stumbled into a building, you know, in Sunnyvale, and they were building a computer and hired me as a programmer. What a great job. This was Tenet. It was called Tenet. They built a great, great computer, great operating system, great languages, everything working on it, debugging, lots of hardware, but there was a recession. They went out of business.
What was the client for those computers?
This was sort of a new computer at a very good price point. It was a medium computer. Not the huge mainframe for the biggest business, but they sold two of these machines to the state of California for the DMV. They ran for 25 years, and when they finally replaced them at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, they bought this stuff from Tandem Computer that just failed, flopped, and I think it was Tandem, and they were screaming, and it was a big, you know, a big financial fiasco.
So these computers did DMV, like managing all the records.
The database.
Accounts. Yeah, database. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Yeah. I was kind of curious because, of course, it's one of the things that was so remarkable, the personal computer revolution a little bit after this, that they were for people like us in the home, which is really a different thing than what was happening prior
well,
to that.
Well, this computer was a little bigger than a home computer.
Yeah, definitely.
But I told one of the executives how back in high school I used to design all these computers, mini computers, and I designed them on paper. I could never afford the chips. And he said, well, they had connections with the chip companies.
Right.
They could get me chips. I would never in my life, I was so shy, I would never dare ask anybody for anything free. You know, I wouldn't talk to anybody about anything except technology. And he got me the chips, and I built it. And while I was building it with a friend down the street, the friend said, you got to meet Steve Jobs. He's in our high school. He understands electronics, and he likes to play pranks like you do. So Steve came out, and we met, and I had like so much more electronics experience, and I claim I had tons more pranks, but he had a couple that I hadn't done, so I was a little envious there. And he had done some neat things that were more on the creative side, like making, you know, claymation movies at high school with some friends. He'd talk about that, and little more into experimentation, drugs, sex, all that.
Okay, so what were the pranks? What are some of the pranks that you first remember doing?
Oh, golly. You know, I remember, I obviously did pranks before high school, but I don't always remember them back that early. But I remember, well, in high school, we had driver training simulators. You're in a car simulator mm-hmm. with a movie playing.
I remember
that. I made ones that would make a police siren. And you start up, you know, I wanted to see if anybody would pull over, which is what you do when you hear a police siren.
Yeah, right.
Nobody pulled over, but I didn't get caught. And I made
how'd you do that? You just have a tape recorder that you record?
No, electronic.
Oh, cool.
You know, charge up capacitor, raise the tone, lower the tone, a little multivibrator circuit, right out of popular electronics. I also made a little very, very high pitched. You almost couldn't hear it. Probably if you were a teacher, you couldn't hear it.
Right.
Such a high pitch. And I'd put 27 batteries on it to last for a month. And then I'd plant this thing behind the TV sets in every classroom, hanging up on the wall.
The TV was off.
And they would go for weeks, and the teacher would say, oh, something wrong with the TV.
Right.
And so
now, did you have a small group of friends that you were telling them about?
No, absolutely. Maybe once in a while I might tell one person. Bill Werner was a friend, but no, basically I learned in junior high school that I almost always got caught, because if you tell one person, they tell everybody, and everybody says, oh, so Steve's got a pin gun, when I didn't even have a pin gun. I had a little design on – a friend of mine had a design on paper. They searched my locker. They found all my spitwad shooters and accused me of having pin guns. I said to the principal, those aren't pin guns. Those are spitwad shooters.
So, one of the things about A Practical Joke, of course, is that everyone gets to laugh about it when it happens.
Sometimes, no.
If you did it by yourself.
No. I learned don't tell anyone. Do it by yourself, and you don't get caught, and you often don't get to see the result. Some of the best ones I did, I would never see the result.
Like?
Well, like one time I accidentally got a call from a bank about a friend here in Los Gatos. His car payment hadn't been received. I said, I'm a lawyer. I'm not going to pay it. And after 2 days, I was talking to the manager. I said, there's no way in the world. My wife wanted that car. I don't care. I'm not even going to pay for it. You can't do a thing about it. It's my car. They said, well, where's the car now? He says, it's here at work. I said, what's your address? I gave him the guy's work address. You know, I said they thought I was Gary. I said, but you won't get it. It's locked. And they said, that won't stop us. But I didn't get to see. See, I didn't get to see the end result of that. Did they pull it? And a lot of the pranks I've pulled were really good ones, and I didn't really get to see them.
What about the ones where people had called you? I remember you were telling me one time about the airline. Pan Am or
sure.
Somebody had called you.
I had good numbers all my life. And this is another later in life story. Back in high school, I did other types of things. But yeah, phone numbers. I got into really good phone numbers and good phone numbers. Well, I had, let me think.
You mean you collected phone numbers?
Oh, over time, I've collected.
You've still got a lot of phone numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, like here in Los Gatos, I've got prime numbers 353-3333. My ex-wife has it. 354-4444 right here. 356-6666. 358-888. 359.
So you definitely like numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't call these numbers because he just collects them. He doesn't use them. So.
Oh, I don't even care. I don't answer them.
Yeah.
I don't answer them. You can call the one that's my home phone. I don't answer it unless I have arranged for a call that day on a landline phone for liability.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my cell phone numbers are equally good. I've got, you know,
888-888.
Well, you can call 888-888, but you aren't going to get me because I get 100 calls a day from little babies pushing the 8 button.
Right.
They can't even talk. And so I got so tired of that when I just have it on a card that plugs in my computer. You can't phone it.
Right.
Yeah.
So why collect numbers?
It started with the very first dial a joke in the Bay Area. I was so into humor, after college, 3 years of college, I was working at Hewlett-Packard as an engineer. Just before Hewlett-Packard, actually, I was working as a technician. No high salary or anything. Apartment rental was my biggest expense. And I decided I wanted to put a dial-a-joke in the Bay Area because no one had ever done it. I want to be the first to do some things in life. And you had to rent the one machine the phone company had. Back then, it was illegal to own, use, or purchase your own answering machine, illegal to own, use, or purchase your own phone. So I had to rent this huge machine that cost a good portion of what my apartment cost. That's why nobody did it. That's why I was the first. And it was a machine. You dial a number. I got 255-6666. I kept trying to get better numbers so that people wouldn't get 100 wrong numbers a day. Everyone that had a number similar to Dial-A-Joke was getting all these wrong numbers and complaining. So I said, got to have an easy number for the kids to dial, 255-6666. And that was my first good number. And now I knew how to talk to a phone company manager. The guy had called me.
Right.
So anytime you want a number, just call me, he said, you know. So over time, I would discover on my dialing, oh, my gosh, I can get a number with six of the same digit. Cupertino, 996-9999. And I called the manager. Can I get this number? Got it for me. You know, so I had the technique. You can, if you know a number that somebody doesn't have, you can just call and ask to get it.
Right.
And one of my best coups was here in Los Gatos. 354-4444 was owned by a towing company. And I'd call it every now and then. And sometimes I'd talk to the towing company and say, how many trucks do you have? They only had two. And I said, well, you going out of business soon? No, we're in business. Well, are you you want this number? Would you give it up? Oh, we want this number. Well, eventually one day I called it. The number had gone away. The company had gone bankrupt or something. Oh, I called the phone company and I said, call us on a certain date. We have to wait 6 months or something. Call us, because it's a business line. You have to wait 6 months. Call us on this date and you can get the number. I waited. I called them a week before that date. I called the number itself and somebody had been given it. I lost my chance for 354-4444. And then, but when people get these numbers that are popular business numbers, they get a lot of wrong numbers and they don't like it. So I kept trying that number every couple of weeks. And sure enough, they gave it up and I got it.
Right.
So you work. So it takes a little bit of work.
Persistence.
But one time I had this great number, 2211111. In the days of rotary dial phones, the shortest number dial were ones and the next were twos. There's only one number that was legal by the rules of numbers in the United States, only one number that had only two twos and five ones. Everything else had to have at least one more distance on a rotary dial phone, a third two. So there was no other number that good. There was only one seven-digit combination, 2211111. And I got it in 408 area code. And I got all day long. I'd get like 60 wrong numbers. Hello, hello. They hang up. Hello, hello. They hang up. And so one time I was booking a flight for myself, and I discovered Pan Am had 800-221-1111. So the next time I got one of these hello calls and they hang up, are you calling Pan Am? She said, yeah. I said, oh, well, we're on our coffee break. What can I do for you? I mean, I'm an improv guy. You know, you always say improv, first rule. You always say yes. And I booked my first flight. And then I started playing with people, seeing would they accept weird things like flights at 3 in the morning? See, Pan Am doesn't even exist at the San Jose airport. I would give them atrocious prices that were $1,000 and it should be $100. And you have anything cheaper, you know? And I started making up funny games. I'd say, well, yeah, we have some seats in freight. You just have to wear warm clothes, but they're, you know, it's regular seats. And they would buy it, you know. And after about 2 weeks of doing this, I said, you know what? Somebody's going to figure out what number they called. They went to the airport at 3 in the morning.
Right.
Nobody was there. They're gonna call the police. And the police are just going to make calls to me and find out that you know, catch me at my game. So I said, I love this game. So here's what I'll do. I'll book the phony's flights, and then I'll say, I'm just a prankster. I'm not really Pan Am. So at the end. So for 2 years straight, I answered my phone. Pan Am, international desk, Greg speaking. I always use the name Greg. If there was a guy that worked for Pan Am named Greg, he got fired. And my friends would say, oh, Steve, it's me. But for 2 years, I would book the phoniest flights I could think of. I'd fly them up to Moscow, Idaho, down Amarillo, Texas, up to Billings, Montana, Lexington, Kentucky,
and
then to Boston.
Ready. They loved it. They were ready to buy it.
And I'd call it the Grasshopper Special. I'd say, every time you go through our lesser used airports, it cuts your fare down. And they would believe this. I would tell them, you fly to Las Vegas, you go to our window, you roll the dice. If you get a 7, the next leg is free. And they would believe it. They would believe it. I would tell them propeller service has become a lot less expensive, and I'd sell them a lower ticket. I tried to sell a guy a 30-hour flight to London once. He wouldn't take that. But I sold a lady a 20-hour flight to New York.
And so did you normally close that with, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I would say, I'm not really Pan Am. I'm just a joker. And sometimes they didn't have a good reaction to that.
I can't imagine why they wouldn't. Like,
they'd say, go to H. And I'd say, we don't have any direct flights. One guy said, I dialed the 800. I said, well, if you dialed the 800, you got the Pan Am and you can show up at the airport when I told you.
Right. So why do you like doing pranks? What is it about it that...
I don't know. Maybe just because I discovered I was good at little deceptive ways of saying things, keeping a straight, very straight face about something that is almost atrociously ridiculous and impossible. And I throw in a lot of knowing these weird little facts that I've read in the paper lately, something that is that people doubt on that can't be real. Whenever they challenge me, say it's not real, it's true. So I got very good at saying things people would challenge me when it was true, and they'd accept it when it was just total weird, you know, BS, you know.
All the phone numbers you just mentioned, you've memorized most of your life. Do you do that with most numbers?
A lot of times that happens to me. Like, I could go back, a lot of the hotels I've stayed at, I remember the numbers and why they were good, and 419. Why is 419 any good? It was a hotel I stayed at one of the weeks of Dancing with the Stars. 419, 4 is 2 squared, 1 is 1 squared, and 9 is 3 squared. And so I remember it. And I had 8319 out in Orlando when I met my dancing partner. And I remembered, what is 8319? These are crappy numbers. They don't add up to anything that mathematically has good sense. And I said, well, it starts with an 8, and 8's a good number. 8's a lucky number in China. It's my favorite number for phone numbers. And it's 2 cubed. It's a power of 2. It's a magic computer number. And then that caused me to notice that a number ends with 9, which is 3 squared. Okay. So I've got 2 cubed and 3 squared. It's almost 2 and 3s backwards. Okay. That's sort of interesting. In the middle, 31. The room number was 8319. 31 is in the middle. 31 is a 2 to the n, a magic computer number, a power of 2, minus 1. And that's what all of our encryption codes and the highest prime numbers are based on. So it's mathematically a good number. So I remember it. I always try to find a good formula, but I don't always succeed.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. This is a pre-recorded show. I'm Lyle Troxell. Also with me is Al Luckow. We're in Steve Wozniak's house. Steve Wozniak's the creator of the Apple computer.
I think the things that are really interesting are the stuff you did with the $2 bills. I mean, I was at a basketball game with him.
Oh, my gosh.
And he gave me some money. Life. He goes, hey, go get me some hot dogs. Let's go get some hot dogs. I'll give you some money. I go, okay. And he gives me a sheet of $2 bills. To go pay for them.
I very often carry them on me, like today.
Yeah, there we go. We've got.
And they come out of pads. I have pads of these things. They're just bills and bills and bills, and they're all in a pad, and they're very suspicious looking. First of all, they're brand new money, so they smell. I tell people, be careful how you hold it. The ink is wet. The ink's wet, so be careful how you hold it. Hold it on a corner. You won't get your hands messy. I say these pads are made by a printer in my town of Los Gatos. Well, that's true. The pad is made there. I say he gets the supplies from a higher quality printer. They think that I've said he prints them, which would be illegal. And then these are brand new, and they're $2 bills, which is unusual.
Right.
They're in pads. They're on sheets, and they're perforated. And if you look at the serial number, you'll notice they all look the same at first. They all look the same. Serial numbers change in the middle.
Why is the third digit different?
On a sheet, they change the serial numbers in the middle. So, and then I sell these sheets for $5, which I do. If you would like that, that's 4 $2 bills for $5. And since they're worth $3 each, they cost me $3 each.
Right.
You're buying $12 for five. I mean, only an idiot would turn that down. And of course, people think they're counterfeit. I won't touch it. They won't take it from me.
I'll buy it from you for five.
Yeah, you will, because you know this.
So people most of the time.
But here's the line I love the most. I came up with this. I said, these bills are legal tender. They meet the specs of the U.S. government. So by law, they are legal tender. And when I say that, somehow they're distracted by this by law. They are legal. Why would he say that sort of thing? And it gets them. They stop challenging what might be wrong about them. They think that somehow they're handmade, but they're legal is what I'm saying, and they can't be. And I say, oh, no, Secret Service approved them 3 times. Truth. I only tell the truth when I'm telling the story. The only lie that I ever tell people is sometimes I say, I don't even know if it's the right president. And I do know it's the right president for a $2 bill. That's the only lie I tell. But I say the Secret Service, you know, approved them 3 times, and 2 of the times I remember. Sounds such a weird statement. How could anybody say something? It's actually true.
So what happened?
And there were 3 times, and 2 of them I remember. And one of them, I think I just was chatting with somebody that said he was close to the Secret Service or some stupid thing. And then I say, the one time when the Secret Service read me my Miranda rights, I gave him a phony ID. I could go get it from my backpack that says I'm a laser safety officer and I have an eye patch in the picture. And when I tell that story, people are just thinking that everything I'm saying is a total lie and everything's totally true. I did bamboozle the Secret Service.
Why?
With an ID. It was a phony ID that said Department of Defiance. But you know how when you see a word, your brain, if the starts and ends the right way, Department of Defense is what you see.
Right. So why do you have the ID and when I made up
the ID as a joke, just a joke. And when I was challenged by the Secret Service, well, $2 bills got bothered a manager in a casino when I tipped a waitress two of these $2 bills.
Because they were perforated together.
So I walked back down to the gymnastics meet where my daughter was. My wife took the longest time. I didn't know she was being interrogated by the Secret Service. She didn't appreciate that a bit. And then they came and they wanted to talk to me. And I figured, oh, they just want to write down a name for their records, who's got these bills. They want to go into a private room. Guy opens up a chrome briefcase and pulls out a little laminated card and says, I'm going to read you your Miranda rights. Back in my head, first of all, don't show any emotion about that. But, you know, I'm going to screw with these guys. If they're, you know, this is the point where you can walk up and say, nope, I don't want to do it. I'm walking away. And they say, well, we're going to hold you on suspicion for 72 hours. Uh-huh. So, and I know my $2 bills are good. They knew they were good. The casino guy had told me they'd even tested the bills with their pen. They were good.
Why were they continuing?
Well, I don't know. So I don't understand. So I decided I'm going to give that guy – I have two choices. He wanted an ID. Give him my driver's license or give him my laser safety officer with an eye patch ID. And I gave him the laser safety. I'd used that for 5 years. Every airplane flight I took for 5 years of my life, that was the ID that got me on the plane. So I handed it – Department of Defiance. And I handed it to him. And he noted the name and he handed it back.
Is it your name on it?
Catch it as a fake. Yeah, Steve Wozniak. I signed it on the backwards. A little fishy. I signed it with my name backwards, Evitz Kainzow. But he gave it back and didn't even challenge the ideas. That probably was a crime.
Right.
But I had to do it. You're only going to get one chance in your life to give the Secret Service a fake ID. that funny.
Yeah.
What a funny story I got out of it. And he interrogated me for about 40 minutes, an hour. You know, he was just asking every question. Where'd you get the bills made? I don't remember the printer. Some friend of mine knew a printer in Santa Cruz or something. And, you know, I told him all the truth.
Ultimately, if you're going to counterfeit money, you wouldn't counterfeit $2 bills because they really stick out. I mean, people should really think when they get this. I mean, why would you do $2 bills?
Of course, that means it's the perfect thing.
I mean, it'd be like.
Well, this guy was a rookie. I asked him if he knew 1-800-COLLECT. He didn't even know it. He's a rookie, man. Mm-hmm. And it was Sunday, and he didn't have anything else to do in Las Vegas. He was just learning the ropes. They want to get every little detail about any weird money, legal or not. Yeah, he knew the money was good.
Does the printer friend that makes books of these for you, does he perfect them?
Yes.
Okay.
No, he gums them at the top, puts them in pads with a cardboard backing. I'd show you if I had my backpack down here. And I've spent them for years. Yeah, I love them.
Because when you buy this – you get them in sheets, but they're not perforated. Right?
Yeah, what I do is if you look at the back of a $10 bill, mm-hmm. It's a Treasury Department building on 16th Street, a few blocks from the White House. Well, if you walk down 14th Street instead of 16th Street, the same number of blocks, Treasury Department, Bureau of Engraving and Printing. That's one of two places they make our money. That's where they make the most of our money. Mm-hmm. Well, I go in there and they'll sell you a sheets of money. When I first started doing this, only ones and twos were available on sheets. Then they added fives, then they added tens and twenties. Finally, they added fifties. You can't get hundreds on sheets. You can get a sheet of four specimens, eight specimens, 16 specimens, or 32 specimens. I have the big sheets. I used to fold up the big sheets, carry them around town here, and I'd buy something, pull a sheet out of my pocket, unfold it, and get some scissors. I'd carry scissors, and I'd cut them a weird shaped thing. And they're looking at it like, where do I put this in my cash register? Do I challenge it? And nobody has to take your money. Right. They can turn it down for any reason whatsoever. I get these twos turned down all the time. I give myself a point if somebody thinks it's counterfeit, and I lose a point if they believe everything I said, which is so ridiculous.
And there's no extra fee for these.
And then, yes, there is. Yeah, I told you I bought them for $3. I don't lie. I don't lie when I'm giving you that whole spiel that makes you think these things are counterfeit. There's something fishy. Oh, no. You buy them on a sheet of four specimens. They cost $3.10 for each $2 bill. And to get that price, you have to buy them in bulk. If you go to the Bureau of Engraving Printing, you can buy one of these framed and you'll pay like $8 a bill or $10 a bill. They're real expensive.
Yeah.
But I buy them in bulk. I get them for $3.10. Or if I buy the bigger sheets of 32, I get them for $2.65 a bill. Well, I buy the big sheets and my printer slices them down to these fours. And then we look at the serial numbers. I always make sure they send me serial numbers that are in order. So this is 130, 131, 132.
So you invest in your jokes.
Yeah, in other words, if I go and spend this sheet, I get $8 of spending, but it costs me $12. Yes, I invest a little in my jokes. Yeah. What I love to do is get people thinking these are counterfeit and say, "Here, why don't you order some Cokes with these?" And then I call my friends who are in security and have them come up and accost the guy.
Yeah.
And I've learned that you can make people cry if they think the Treasury Department is calling them at home over some bills that they thought were counterfeit and they'd get away with it because WAS spends them. You know, okay, they can cry. And then I found that if you tell them the right story, you can get people to laugh and cry at the same time. While they're crying, they're laughing about doing it on somebody else.
So are you okay with making friends cry?
Not totally. No, that's the extreme.
Yeah.
That's the extreme, and that's going too far. So a couple occasions it happened because of $2 bills. And in each occasion, I wound up talking to the person and making it sound so – telling them the real true story and getting them seeing how funny it would be to go do it on a friend of theirs. And then they wind up laughing and crying at the same time. If they're laughing about doing it on somebody else, their crying isn't as bad.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever lost a friend to a practical joke on bad?
Oh, no. No, never.
And there's our discussion with Steve Wozniak at his home in Los Gatos. And after the talk, he had to rush off to get a haircut. And so instead of jumping in one of his Priuses, he jumped onto a Segway. Yeah, we didn't even mention, but he plays Segway Polo. Segway is one of those standing devices that you lean forward and it wheels you around. It's two wheels and drives you around. He grabbed one of his Segways and jumped on it to go get his haircut and came back a second later and said, let's do lunch. So after his haircut down Los Gatos, he drove up at the restaurant on his Segway. We happened to run into some Apple employees at the restaurant. They were excited to meet Woz. There's something about Woz that just, I don't know, puts a smile on your face. If you saw him on Dancing Stars, you know what I mean. In general, from this discussion, you can tell he's a very genuine, excited person about a lot of things. I can't think of a better person to represent the Uber geek, the lead geek, if you will. I think that medal and belt and title, whatever, goes to Woz, hands down.
Hi, this is Steve Wozniak here. You might know me from my $2 bill stories and TV jammer stories. When I'm in Santa Cruz, I listen to Geek Speak.
This week's crazy USB device. Last week, Ben mentioned a story about USB warming gloves. Well, of course, if you got your warm hands, what about your toesies? Yeah, this week it's USB slippers. You can buy them, you can plug them into your computer, and they will warm your feet. Now, of course, don't walk around because you'll trip. So they're really for sitting down and warming your toes. Okay, coming up next is Car Talk here on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. And of course, if you're interested more about today's visit with Woz, you can see photographs and videos and all that stuff up at geekspeak.org. We had a great time with him.
I counted license plates from 000. And then once I found a license plate that said 000, I started looking. I found one that said 001. And sometimes it took me 3 months to find 03. Sometimes you'll find four in a day. Sometimes it'll take you a long time to find one number. And so, well, I actually finished that game then. I went for 8 years. And by the last couple of years, I would say this is the stupidest thing I ever did in my life. This game is so hard. It's so ridiculous. It is so worthless to spend this much time, and I have to play it because I'm in it. I'm up in the 900s now. Yeah. So I finished it with $9.99. I didn't go out and drink champagne. I didn't have a party. I didn't celebrate. I didn't call any friends. I didn't do anything. The game was over.